Chapter 54. Exultantly, General Aitchison traversed his binoculars across the group of hills. Vaguely through the dust and smoke, he could pick out their crests. "A fair cop, sir," Peterson grinned. "A fair cop indeed," Aitchison agreed. They had to shout above the thunder of the guns, and beneath them their horses fidgeted and trembled. A dispatch rider galloped up, saluted, and handed Peterson a message. "What is it?" Aitchison asked without lowering his glasses. "Both Nichols and Simpson are in position for the assault. They seem anxious to engage, sir." Then Peterson looked up at the holocaust of dust and flame upon the hills. "They'll be lucky if they can find anyone left to fight up there." "They will," Aitchison assured him. He was not misled by the deceptive fury of the barrage. They had survived worse at Spion Kop. "Are you going to let them go, sir?" Peterson insisted gently. For another minute, Aitchison watched the hills. Then he lowered his glasses and pulled his watch from his breast pocket. 4 o'clock. 3 hours more of daylight. "Yes," he said. "Send them in." And Peterson scribbled the order and handed it to Aitchison for his signature. "Here, Komala!" LaRue heard the shout in the ceaseless roar of the shells, heard it taken up and passed along the line. "Here they come! Boss up! They're coming!" He stood up, and his stomach heaved at the movement. Poisoned by the lyddite fumes, he fought his nausea, and when he had controlled it, he looked out along the river. For a second, the veil of dust opened, so he could see the tiny lines of khaki moving in towards the hills. Yes, they were coming. He ran down his own line towards the river, shouting as he went, "Wait! Wait until they are certain! Don't shoot until they reach the markers!" From this corner of the koppie, he could look out over every quarter of the field. "Yeah, I thought so," he muttered. "They come from two sides to split us." Advancing on the frontage of the river were those same lines of tiny figures. The lines bulged and straightened and bulged again, but always they crept slowly nearer. Already the leading rank was moving up on his 1,000-yard markers. In another 5 minutes they would be in range. "They stand out well," LaRue muttered, as he ran his eyes along the rows of markers. While most of his men were building the earthworks along the koppies and the river, others had paced out the ranges in front of these defences. Every 250 yards they had erected those small cairns of stones, and over each they had smeared whitish-grey mud from the river. It was a trick the British never seemed to understand, and as they advanced the Boer rifles had their range almost to the yard. "The river is safe," he decided. "They cannot break through there." And he allowed himself time to grin. "They never learn. Every time they come against the worst side." Then he switched his attention to the assault on his left flank. This one was dangerous. This was where he must command in person. And he ran back to his original position, while around him and overhead the storm of shrapnel and lyddite roared on unabated. He dropped on his belly between two of his burghers, wriggled forward, unbuckling the bandolier from around his chest, and draped it over the boulder beside him. "Good luck, Oom Paul," a burgher called. "And to you, Hendrik," he answered, as he set the rear sight of his Mauser at 1,000 yards, then laid the rifle on the rock in front of him. "Close now," the burgher beside him muttered. "Very close. Good luck, and shoot straight." Suddenly the storm lifted and there was silence. A vast, aching silence, more shocking than the buzzing, howling roar of the guns. The dust and the smoke drifted away from the crests, and after its gloom, the sunshine burned down brightly on the hills, and the golden brown plain. It sparkled with dazzling brilliance on the sweeping waters of the Fal, and it lit each tiny khaki figure with stark intensity, so their shadows lay dark on the earth beneath them. They reached the line of markers. LaRue picked up his rifle. There was one man he had been watching, a man who walked a little ahead of his line. Twice LaRue had seen him pause as if to shout an order to those who followed him. "You first, my friend," and he took the officer in his sights, holding him carefully in the notch with the bead obscuring his trunk. Gently he took up the slack in the trigger, and the recoil slammed back into his shoulder. With the vicious and characteristic crack of the Mauser stinging his eardrums, LaRue watched the man go down into the grass. "Yeah," he said, and reloaded. Not in simultaneous volley, not with the continuous wild crackle which they had used at Colenso, but in a careful, steady stutter, which showed that each shot was aimed, the Boer rifle started the hunt. "They have learned," LaRue muttered, as he worked the bolt of his rifle, and the empty case pinged away among the rocks. "They have learned well," and he killed another man. At two places on the ridge, the Maxim guns began their frenzied hammering bursts. Before it reached the second row of markers, the first line of infantry no longer existed. It was scattered back in the grass, completely annihilated by the terrible accuracy of the Boer fire. The second line walked over them and came on steadily. "Look at them come!" shouted a burgher further down the line. Though he had seen it a dozen times before, all of these ragged farmers were awed by the passive, impersonal advance of British infantry. "These men fight not to live, but to die," muttered the man who lay beside LaRue. "Then let us help them to die," LaRue shouted. And below him on the plain, the slow, inexorable ranks moved forward towards the third row of markers. "Shoot, girls! Shoot straight!" LaRue roared, for now he could see the bayonets. He pressed a clip full of ammunition down into the magazine, and with the back of his hand brushed the clinging drops of sweat from his eyebrows, pushed the rifle forward, and knocked down four men with his next six shots. Then he saw the change. At one place the line bulged as men began to hurry forward, while on the flanks it wavered and disintegrated as others hung back or crouched down behind pitifully inadequate cover. "They're breaking!" LaRue howled excitedly. "They won't reach the slopes!" The forward movement faltered. No longer able to stand the mauling they were receiving, men turned back or went to ground, while their officers hurried along the ranks, goading them on. In so doing, they proclaimed to the Boer riflemen that they were officers, and at that range they did not survive long. "They have finished!" shouted LaRue, and a thin burst of cheering ran along the ridge, while the Boer fire increased in volume, flailing into the milling confusion of a broken infantry assault. "Hit them, carols! Keep hitting them!" The following ranks overran the leaders, then in turn faltered and failed as the Maxim and Mauser fire churned into them. Out on the plain a bugle began to lament, and as it mourned, the last spasmodic forward movement of the assault ceased, and back past the dead and the wounded streamed the retreat. A single shell rushed overhead to burst in the valley beyond, and immediately, as if in frustrated fury, the guns lashed the kopje once more. But in the jump and flash of the shells, 500 Boers cheered and laughed and waved their rifles at the retreating infantry. "What happened on the river?" LaRue called in the tumult. And after a while the answer came back. "They did not reach the river. They are broken there also." LaRue lifted his hat from his head and wiped the sweat and the dust from his face. Then he looked at the sunset. "Almighty God, we give you thanks for this day. We ask your mercy and guidance in the days that are to come." The shellfire lashed the hills like the surf of a storm-driven sea until the night came. Then, in the darkness, they saw the fires of the British bivouacs spread like a garden of yellow flowers on the plains around them.